From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, if polls are right, Republicans are in big trouble with Latino voters.
Latino voters will become the number one swing voter group in the country.
We'll take a look at how Latino voters could shape the 2012 presidential election, plus the story behind the mysterious affliction that's affected 18 high school girls in Leroy, New York. And the Southern Baptist Convention is getting ready for a big change, its first black president.
I think what this election would do, if I am elected, it would say, hey, we're not only talking this thing, we're putting our money where our mouth at.
And later, how Booker T. Washington and Sears and Roebuck President Julius Rosenwald revolutionized education for African-American children in the South in the early 20th century, and new music from Ivory Coast by way of Washington, D.C., almost lost in the decade-long Civil War. That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered.
All right. Enough with the snappy music. NPR, I've got one of your guests in studio. Are you there?
There's a man in Phoenix with a political playbook that's become very valuable. It's so valuable, in fact, that the Obama campaign believes it could help clinch the president's reelection. He's a Phoenix City councilman, and his name is Daniel Valenzuela. Daniel, what were you doing before you were elected to city council?
I'm a valley firefighter here in a neighboring city. It's Glendale, Arizona, and I'm currently still a firefighter with the Glendale Fire Department.
And I'm not trying to embarrass you, but you actually do not speak Spanish, right?
Well, you're not trying to embarrass me. No, I'm not fluent.
Daniel Valenzuela is a fourth-generation Mexican-American, a political independent, and just to clarify, he's working on his Spanish. Anyway, last year, he won a seat on the Phoenix City Council in a traditionally Republican district, and he did it by increasing Latino voter turnout by 488%.
I decided early on that this campaign would be a campaign for a social behavioral change, to get people active, register to vote, realize the power of a vote, and to get them to cast that vote.
Our cover story today, how Latino voters will shape American politics from now on. And in Daniel Valenzuela's case, he did it the old-fashioned way. He recruited a group of local university students who knocked on 72,000 doors, occasionally in the punishing Arizona heat. And one of those student volunteers was Vanya Guevara. Vanya, hello, Vanya.
Hi.
Tell us about yourself.
I'm Vanya Guevara.
She's a first-generation American. Her parents are from El Salvador. And Guevara explains that the student volunteers were able to tap into the frustration many folks in the community felt over Arizona's tough anti-immigration laws.
And I think that's exactly what triggered a lot of it was SB 1070 and what Arpaio is doing in our communities. Also, tuition increases, and a lot of our Dream Act students basically got kicked out of school because of a proposition that increased tuition significantly, and so it was for a lot of reasons.
Okay, if you didn't catch that, Vanya Guevara mentioned three issues. SB 1070, that's Arizona's tough new immigration law that critics say encourages racial profiling. She also mentioned Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He's a Republican. And the Justice Department here in Washington cited his office for, quote, a pervasive culture of discriminatory bias against Latinos. And the DREAM Act, that's a bill that would provide a path to citizenship for undocumented college students or members of the military, and it's largely opposed by Republican lawmakers. Now, those issues, among others, mobilized so many people in Western Phoenix that it eventually inspired a recent Time magazine cover, photos of Latinos and two words, Yo Decido, I Decide. And as I mentioned, Valenzuela's team managed to increase Latino turnout in that one district in Phoenix by nearly 500%.
We witnessed the greatest grassroots effort in the history of Phoenix politics.
It was so successful, the Obama campaign sent an operative to Phoenix to learn more about Valenzuela's game plan and how to apply it nationwide.
I absolutely believe that Arizona is in play. The Latino voting turnout increased by nearly 500% in one particular district. But over the city of Phoenix, which is the sixth largest city in the country, mind you, it actually increased by 300% across the board.
And here's the thing. Latinos, like the ones who voted in Phoenix, people who had never voted before could turn out across the country in such numbers this year that they might hold the power to swing the presidential election. And the way things are looking now, that's bad news for Republicans.
When I hear some of the policies and the rhetoric that's coming out of the GOP debates, I hear very little other than anti-immigration reform.
Well, the answer is self-deportation, which is
we need to secure the border with technology and guns.
Learn to speak the English language, learn American history and our Constitution. That's the American.
And if you want to be an American, the first thing you should do is respect our laws and obey our laws. And
those things bother me personally, and I know that I'm not alone.
Back in 2004, George W. Bush won 44% of the Latino vote. One of his supporters was Didi Garcia Blaze. She founded a group for Latino Republicans called Somos Republicans. Didi's an Air Force veteran. She's a fifth-generation Mexican-American and a lifelong Republican. But last year,
I started to see the Republican Party marginalize Hispanics. Basically, they just wanted them to keep a lid on the immigration issue.
And so she did something drastic. She abandoned the GOP and Somos Republicans, and she now expects to vote for President Obama in the fall, even though this is what she believes in.
Strong national defense, capitalism, free market thinking, less taxes, and the pro-life issue.
This past week, Fox News published a poll showing Mitt Romney winning just 14% of the Latino vote in a race against President Obama. Now, today, more than half of U.S. population growth is being fueled by the Latino community. The reason this is so important to presidential politics? Because of where that population growth is happening. It's happening in states like Arizona, as we mentioned, but also Florida, Virginia, and Colorado. These are states that have often voted Republican, but places, says demographer Rui Teixeira, that could soon swing the other way.
President Obama polls 75% of the minority vote. He can lose white voters by huge margins and still win the election,
wow,
including white working class voters. I mean, you assume he's got not exactly locked down, but pretty steady for the African-American vote. Mm. But Hispanics can be a more volatile constituency. But if Obama can get the margin that he got in 2008 from these voters, he's going to get 75% of the minority vote. He may get 80% of the minority vote again, which is what he got in 2008. And that doesn't exactly make him bulletproof, but it certainly gets him a long way toward getting reelected.
Rui Teixeira calls North Carolina, Virginia, and Florida the new South swing states, places where the Latino population has exploded in the past decade. We sent producers Shannon Novak, Sam Greenspan, and Greg Collard to a strip mall in Charlotte, North Carolina.
So what's your name, age, and where are you from?
To a supermarket in Falls Church, Virginia.
Sorry? I gotta go to the store to buy some.
I can walk with you if you'd like.
And to the busy streets of South Florida.
We are in beautiful downtown Miami.
To speak to Latino voters with roots in many different countries.
I am from Argentina.
Colombia. Cuba.
Mexico.
El Salvador.
And I'm from Dominican Republic.
And what are the issues that are important to you this election?
In this election, economy.
Probably the job for everybody.
The economy.
Very important to me, that's for immigration.
Immigration. Better help on education.
You have student debt?
A lot.
How much?
I would say about $60,000.
What do you think when you look at this presidential election?
I don't like the candidates. I'd rather stay with the one we have.
The Republicans, I don't like nobody.
Do you know who you're going to vote for?
Well, for me, I'm voting for Obama again.
And Barack Obama, no, thank you, no anymore. He don't make nothing, only promise, and I don't know when.
They fool us, Latinos, with promises and then nothing. Nothing ever becomes a reality. So now we no longer trust politicians because, honestly, they never keep their promises.
Obama, because I think that he has helped us a lot.
I like Obama. He have a good idea, but the Republican don't let him do nothing.
Obama has been good for the Latino people, and he could provide a program so these 10 or 12 million Latinos become citizens.
Obama quiere ayudar.
I know that Obama wants to help, but the Republicans don't let him because of racism. They don't let him, and I know that he wants to help.
Voices from Charlotte, North Carolina, Falls Church, Virginia, and Miami. Political demographer Rui Teixeira, who we heard from earlier, says the long competitive Republican primary is part of the reason more Latinos are turning away from the GOP. That race continues this week with primaries in Alabama, which recently passed a tough anti-immigration law of its own, and also in Mississippi, where the governor has endorsed a similar immigration crackdown.
Yeah, Latino voters are listening to this very closely. We've had the spectacle during the Republican primaries of the candidates essentially trying to outdo one another in the hard line they take on immigration.
With the exception of Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul, who have taken a somewhat more moderate
Newt slightly said something that might have been interpreted as a little more liberal, but he quickly had to backtrack. Yeah. And that's been the story of these primaries. The moment anyone shows the slightest degree of softness, the others pile on. You know, they're all against the DREAM Act. They're all against in-state tuition.
Mitt Romney says he would veto the DREAM Act if it
Absolutely. He's been very clear about it. That's a 90% issue with Latinos. So believe me, people notice, and especially Latino voters notice, and it just reinforces this image of the Republican Party as being unwelcoming to immigrants, not the party for Hispanic voters.
Roy, George W. Bush won 44% of the Latino vote in 2004. In your estimate, how much of the Latino vote does the eventual Republican nominee have to win to have a chance at defeating President Obama?
So if they can get 40% again, at least puts them with hailing distance. Basically, what happens is the smaller a percentage of the Hispanic vote you get, that just means you've got to make it up with the white vote. The barrier becomes ever higher that you have to jump over. Mm. And there's a limit to how much blood you can squeeze from a stone. They don't have to get, 40%, but the more they get figures like 31%, like McCain did in 2008, or in the 20s, like they're polling now, the harder it gets for them.
Could one argue that there is a model for Republicans in Texas? Because obviously the Latino population has grown in Texas, and Texas is more Republican than ever. I mean, both houses and the legislature and the governor.
Well, that's primarily attributable to the fact that the white population has become more conservative over time. Though even that may be starting to change. And we see in the big metro areas, we have a more cosmopolitan mix of whites. We have more college-educated folks. And if you add on to that the increasing density of Hispanic population in Texas, there's a very reasonable argument that over the next 10 years, Texas becomes more competitive, not less competitive.
In other words, Texas can become a state that votes primarily for Democrats in the next 10
years? It could at least become a purple state, let's put it that way, that's contested between the two parties. I think that's quite possible.
Demographer Rui Teixeira is with the Center for American Progress. Now, some GOP strategists think Florida Senator Marco Rubio may be their secret weapon in winning Latino votes, especially if he's tapped as the vice presidential nominee. We'll talk to a Republican pollster who's advised Rubio and others about what Republicans can do to capture the Latino vote and the presidency. Stay with us. That's next on All Things Considered from NPR News. This week, a Fox News Latino poll found that Latino voters favor President Obama by a 6-to-1 margin over any of the Republican candidates. Whit Ayers is the founder and president of North Star Opinion Research. It's a national public opinion research firm. He's a Republican consultant who counts many of the party's stars as clients. Now, he's been arguing that Republicans need to develop a better strategy to win Latino voters, but he also feels that those numbers I just mentioned, well, they're somewhat misleading.
Republicans can do far better than that poll suggests. In his reelection campaign in 2004, President Bush received 44% of the Latino vote nationwide, and a majority of the Latino vote in the Sun Belt states. So we know that a candidate who reaches out and aggressively courts Latino voters can bring them into the Republican fold.
How important do you think Latino voters will be, not just in 2012, but in subsequent elections going forward?
Latino voters will become the number one swing voter group in the country. There's no question that in critical states, Florida, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, and who knows how many others, Latino voters can provide the critical margin of victory.
You said recently at a breakfast meeting with reporters here in Washington, D.C., you said, if we Republicans do not do better among Latinos, we're not going to be talking about how to get back Florida in the presidential race. We're going to be talking about how not to lose Texas. That sounds like an alarm bell you're ringing.
Well, it's an alarm bell for the long-term growth of the party. In 1980, 88% of the American electorate was white. In 2008, 74% of the electorate was white. If we had the same demographics in 2008 that we had in 1980, John McCain would be president of the United States. Republicans are not stupid. We can count. And that means we will do significantly better in the future.
What are the core issues that you think Republicans need to push to appeal to more Latino voters, especially younger Latino voters?
Overwhelmingly, the most important issue in the Latino community today remains the state of the economy and jobs. And everything we can do to get the economy going and to present a picture of the Republican nominee as better for economic growth will mean the Republicans will do better in the Latino community.
Whit, I know you are a prominent GOP consultant. A lot of Republican leaders listen to you. Do you think enough Republicans are taking this issue seriously?
I think the ones who reflect more on the future of the party going forward, look at demographic trends and try to figure out how we are going to be a national governing party, take this issue very seriously.
And the consequences of not taking it seriously?
We'll lose.
That's Republican consultant Whit Ayers. He's the founder and president of North Star Opinion Research. It's a national public opinion research firm. He's also the chairman of the American Association of Political Consultants and the co-founder with Ed Gillespie of Resurgent Republic. Whit Ayers, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now to a story that's gripped a small town in upstate New York for the past 5 months. It's about 18 high school girls in the working-class town of Leroy. It's just outside Rochester. Reporter Susan Dominus wrote about it in this week's issue of the New York Times Magazine, and she says it all started back in October when a high school cheerleader named Katie Krautwurst woke up from a nap.
She found that her head, she told me, was sort of jutting forward uncontrollably. And, you know, it was very uncomfortable. She thought maybe it was muscle spasms, strange tics were flitting across her face. And then they went to a friend's house and they thought it would maybe go away, and it didn't.
So Katie arranged to meet her mom at the emergency room where doctors told her
she was probably having an anxiety attack. But
the same thing was still happening a few days later.
So they demanded some more testing, and I think at the end of the testing, the doctors just sort of said to them that she had tics, and that wasn't enough of an explanation for them.
That explanation was even harder to swallow when, about a month later, Katie's best friend, a girl named Thera,
wakes up from a nap, again a nap. This time she's stuttering. And then goes to cheerleading. There was a game that night. A lot of people see her, that she's unable to get language out. And she, over time, her symptoms really get much, much worse.
2 weeks later, a third girl, Lydia Parker.
Lydia took a nap and woke up. Same thing, she's stuttering. Her mother took her to the emergency room, and just like Thera, Lydia's symptoms got worse. They went from stuttering to arm flailing. Eventually, she was blacking out, and she also felt numbness in her legs. She was in a wheelchair for a while.
Over the course of the next few weeks, months, this spreads to how many girls?
By mid-December, I believe there were 12.
And to date, in Leroy, New York, 18 students in one high school, all stricken with symptoms ranging from twitches to spasms to vocal outbursts.
They were, you know, what's interesting about it is they were very different kinds of kids, for sure. There were great students, there were poor students, there were cheerleaders, there were kids who weren't cheerleaders. All of them did seem to have in common was some kind of serious stressor.
At the time, Katie's mom had just undergone her 13th brain surgery, and she was in a lot of pain.
Katie being a very loving girl, I can only imagine how that would feel for her to see her mom suffering like that.
For Thera, the second girl,
there was an incident in the family that they asked we simply describe as a traumatic loss that happened 3 years ago. And then Lydia had been physically abused by her father.
Doctors eventually suggested that the girls might be suffering from something called conversion disorder.
Conversion disorder is an illness in which the body expresses through physical symptoms emotional stressors that maybe are difficult to talk about.
And it can be, in a way, contagious. It can turn into what's called mass psychogenic illness. It's where the brain causes a physical reaction that mirrors activity we see in others. It's almost like when you yawn, and if I'm sitting in the room with you, I'll yawn too.
I think that's right and probably most neurologists would agree with you that there is some big, complicated continuum that puts yawning at one end and mass psychogenic illness at the other.
But many parents refused to believe what was going on, and the national news media started to converge on the small town.
Is it a disorder or a kind of mass hysteria, or is the cause in effect in their backyard? Tonight, activist Erin Brockovich has launched her own investigation.
In January, Erin Brockovich sent a team to Leroy to test soil near the town high school. Some had suggested a train derailment in 1970 may have leached toxic chemicals into the soil there. It led to a big showdown with the school superintendent, who had the police block the Brockovich team from investigating on the campus. And some people in town wondered whether they were trying to hide something.
And I do think that because they were escorted off the property, it felt like a very Brockovich against the school superintendent kind of situation. I think it did foster quite a bit of mistrust in the community.
Parents seeking answers about a mysterious illness afflicting children in Leroy.
The more the story took over the town, the more town meetings were covered on local news, the more news trucks that showed up, the worse the girls seemed to get, and it took a toll on the town.
There were a lot of stories about people who felt like their real estate was suffering or that people weren't going to move there. I mean, there were parents who voted to keep their children home from a sporting event that was going to happen in Leroy, not even at the high school, at a different school. So there was a sense of isolation, and I think that was really painful to people there, that there was something wrong with the town they lived in.
Now, there's still no clear answer to what happened in Leroy. Susan Domina says some girls seem to be getting better as TV news coverage slows down. And some girls have responded well to antibiotics, which were prescribed on the hunch that the girls may have a rare condition in which a bacteria that causes strep can actually alter brain chemistry.
My sense is that it's about half and half. About half the girls are on antibiotics and about half are not. But overall, the group does really seem to be improving. One of the doctors who's seen many of the young women said that she feels that more and more of her patients are accepting conversion disorder as a diagnosis. And I think that is definitely one of the first steps in healing.
That's reporter Susan Dominus. You can read her story in the New York Times Magazine online now or in print tomorrow. Sunday morning, as it said, is often the most segregated part of the week in America. The Southern Baptist Church is still struggling to repair its segregated past. The Southern Baptist Convention is rooted in the rift over slavery, which it supported, and not too long ago it backed segregation. Now, the church has since apologized, but it's been slow going trying to diversify. 80% of its 16 million members are white. But that's actually starting to change, in part because in a few months, Pastor Fred Luter will seek the presidency of the Southern Baptist Convention, and if he wins, he'll become its first ever African-American president. Luter began his career preaching on the streets of the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans, where he grew up. And he was never formally trained, and in fact, he doesn't come from a long line of preachers either.
And if you knew my family, you'd know why. That is the truth.
Why is that?
Well, we've just had a lot of dysfunction in our family. My mom and dad were divorced when I was 6 years old, and we've had divorces and remarriages all throughout our family history. And when people tell me about their family reunions and how their family get together for this and that, I tell folk, I mean, I would love to have a family reunion. I say, but if we have a family reunion, you'd have to call security. Just wouldn't be a pretty scene. And so it's the grace of God to have me where I'm at, man.
You started preaching on the streets of the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. How did that start?
I grew up in the hood, and my mom worked two or three jobs, so I hung out with a lot of bad guys, did a lot of crazy things I should not have done. And so when I gave my life to the Lord and saw what God did in my life, then I wanted all those guys I ran the street with to experience what I was experiencing. So I would be on the street corners every Saturday of the week, telling my testimony, sharing my faith, passing out tracts. And that's why, I preach real fast. When people hear me preach, they ask me why I preach so fast. And I tell them, well, I started out on the street corner. When you're on the street corner, people are moving fast and quick. You know, they're not sitting down in the pew like that. So I had to say it fast and quick. And now once I came into the church, I never learned how to slow it down. So people come to my church today who remember me way back when and say, man, I remember you. I thought you were crazy. I thought you were a religious nut. But, man, I see you hung in there and you stuck with it. And so I just thank the Lord for it.
It's an amazing story because you went from being a street preacher to the head of the largest Southern Baptist church in Louisiana, the Franklin Avenue Baptist Church. You were the first African-American vice president of the Southern Baptist Convention. You are going to run for president this June when the convention meets in New Orleans. And you would be heading up a church that is still about 80% white. There are Hispanics, Asians, African-Americans. There have been inroads made to those communities, but still a small percentage,
yes.
A relatively small
yes.
percentage. What would you do to try and diversify the Southern Baptist Convention?
I was at the convention in Atlanta in 1996 when this convention apologized for how we were started. It apologized, it's in the records that apologized that it was not anything that we were proud of and that we need to do better by it. And so since that time, this convention has been trying to let the country know, let the world know that this is not just a convention that is lily white and that is not open to folk who are not white. And they've done that, I think, successfully. I think what this election would do, if I am elected, it would say, hey, we're not only talking this thing, we're putting our money where our mouth at. Because, you know, if I'm elected, it won't be because of the few African-Americans that's in that convention center. If I'm elected, it's going to be because of the Anglo messengers who are overwhelmingly have voted for me. It won't be because of the handful of black folk that's going to be in there. So it will say something to the country and to the world that Southern Baptist Convention is not just talking this thing. We're actually walking this thing. And I think that will speak volumes.
That's Pastor Fred Luter. He heads up the Franklin Avenue Baptist Church in New Orleans, and he's seeking the presidency of the Southern Baptist Convention. If he wins in June, he'll become the convention's first African-American president in history. Pastor Fred Luter, thanks so much.
Thank you, my brother. I appreciate the opportunity.
Just outside Washington, D.C., right at the entry point of Prince George's County in Maryland, is an unassuming suburb called Capitol Heights. And just off Central Avenue, around the corner from an industrial zone of warehouses, there's a grove of trees behind an old school bus depot. And right there is where you'll find a priceless piece of American history.
We are in the Ridgely Rosenwald School. It was built in 1927.
That's Stephanie Deutsch. She's the author of our book today. It's called You Need a Schoolhouse, Booker T. Washington, Julius Rosenwald, and the Building of Schools for the Segregated South. We met her at this old restored schoolhouse built with money from a man named Julius Rosenwald. He was the president of Sears and Roebuck and one of the biggest philanthropists of his day back in the early 20th century. Rosenwald partnered with Booker T. Washington to build thousands of schools for African-American children all across the South. Like this one, Ridgely Rosenwald in Capitol Heights, Maryland.
Well, I guess the first and most striking thing is the windows. These 9-over-9 paned windows were very distinctive, very typical of Rosenwald schools.
And very handy for providing light in the early years when many of the buildings had no electricity. This school educated hundreds of African-American children up until the time it was shut down after desegregation. Today, it's been beautifully restored to serve as a community center and a museum. 91-year-old Mildred Ridgely Gray is also here this afternoon. She remembers those early years well. Not only did her family donate the land for the schoolhouse, but she herself was a student at this school.
I was 6 years old.
The first day you walked in?
The first day I walked in.
Do you remember about that? Anything about that first day?
My older sister was my teacher. And I was very insist that I had to call her Miss Maddie.
Miss Maddie would go on to teach two more generations of kids at the school, including Mildred's daughter, Laverne. And Mildred herself eventually became a school principal and an administrator. Now, while Julius Rosenwald is largely forgotten today, his portrait once hung in all of the schools he helped pay for. And Mildred Gray says all of her classmates knew who he was.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The teachers told you, this is a man who gave money to help build this school.
That is correct.
Huh. That's interesting.
That was said in the school, that was said in the home. In my home, we were very much aware.
Rosenwald was one of the richest men in America. And when he decided to start giving his money away, he gave most of it to help persecuted Jewish communities in Europe. But Stephanie Deutsch says a race riot in his hometown of Springfield, Illinois, in 1908 made Rosenwald think twice about the treatment of African Americans in his own country.
In one of his speeches, he said, "We like to look down on the Russians because of the way they treat the Jews, And yet we turn around and the way we treat our African Americans is not much better. The other thing was that one of his friends gave him a copy of Up From Slavery.
Booker T. Washington's autobiography.
Yeah. And it made a big impression on him. And about this time, he had been asked to donate for a YMCA building in Chicago. And he said, well, I'll leave it to my Christian brothers to donate for the YMCA. But if you want to build a YMCA for black people, then come see me.
You quote a man named Robert Moton in your book, and he said, it was a fortunate day for black folks when Julius Rosenwald and Booker T. Washington met and decided that they trusted each other. What led up to that day?
Both men, Washington and Rosenwald, had become involved with the YMCA movement. And someone connected with the YMCA put them together. And Rosenwald gave a luncheon for Washington, and they met at that luncheon. And they did. They met and trusted each other. And I think probably it was my fascination with that moment that led to this book. They came from totally different backgrounds, but they had certain things in common. One was they were both quite practical people. They were very focused on analyzing problems and then finding solutions.
Who came up with the idea to create schools for kids?
That was Washington's idea. His big belief was that education was the building block on which people would build better lives and stronger lives.
You write about how Washington said, look, you can't just give the money and build the schools. You've got to make this a community effort and a community project all over the country where these schools are going to be built. He got the community involved to the point where they were actually donating labor and material to build these schools, including probably this one that we're sitting in.
Yeah, that was a crucial insight. Booker T. Washington knew that in a lot of these small communities, people were already trying to figure out a way to get a school. They desperately wanted schools for their children. He also knew that Rosenwald, one of his beliefs about philanthropy was, you teach a man to fish, you don't give him a fish. Rosenwald always believed in matching grants. A lot of his philanthropy had been done that way. So the idea of partnering with the community was very, very much in keeping with Rosenwald's thinking.
Eventually, more than 5,000 of these schoolhouses were built all over the South, the segregated South. They weren't just schools. I mean, these were also community centers.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about them. They were built to be somewhat flexible. Many of them had large rooms with partitions in the middle of them, so they could be divided into two classrooms, but they could also open up to be a community center. And at a time when blacks were excluded from public libraries, public playgrounds, and many other public facilities, the Rosenwald School was really theirs. And so it became became the heart of the community in many places.
Stephanie, you can't escape the fact that these were segregated schoolhouses. And I wonder if a part of this legacy is also the perpetuation of a segregated system.
I don't think so. I think that the legacy is, actually one of empowerment, because the people who participated in creating the Rosenwald schools, the people who saw their children getting educated in the Rosenwald schools, they had had a hand in getting what they wanted for themselves. They wanted schools, they got them. They wanted places where they could, where their community could get together. They wanted that, they got it. And one of the sort of aha moments that I had in doing my research was when I was looking at footage of people walking to work during the Montgomery bus boycott. And I realized, gosh, some of them went to Rosenwald schools. And if they didn't go to Rosenwald schools, their mothers and fathers did. And it was that attitude, that can-do attitude, we're going to build a school, we're poor, but we're going to donate money, we're going to donate labor, we're going to create this school. That was the same attitude that really undergirded the civil rights movement.
What happened to the Rosenwald schoolhouses at the end of segregation?
In most places, when segregation ended, the consolidated school was placed in the white building. It was usually a bigger building, often a better building. It happened at different times in different places. I do know of one Rosenwald school out in Rappahannock County that functioned for a year as an integrated school and then was closed. In many places, the schools were kind of boarded up, and some of them fell apart and vanished. Some of them passed into private hands. The one out in Rappahannock County became the county dump. Literally, they put the dumpsters in the front yard, and weeds grew up all around it. And one of the really interesting things that's happened in recent years is that in many, many places in the South, alumni are looking at their schools and saying, I want to preserve that school that was such an important part of my life, or my mother's life, or my father's life. And so there are lots of places where, like what they did here at Ridgely, they're renovating the schools and restoring them.
That's author Stephanie Deutsch. She's written a new book. It's called You Need a Schoolhouse, Booker T. Washington, Julius Rosenwald, and the Building of Schools for the Segregated South. And we had this conversation here at one of those Rosenwald schools, the Ridgely Rosenwald School in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is now a restored community center. Stephanie Deutsch, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for music. This is a band called Zieti, and it's a band that was torn in half by war and geography, and whose first recordings were actually lost forever. This album, Zieti's debut, was 13 years in the making. It's called Zemelowa. Zieti is made up of four musicians, two from the U.S. and two from Ivory Coast, the West African nation that's still recovering from the civil war that raged off and on for the past decade. The name Zieti refers to that struggle in Ivory Coast.
Zieti is the baton of courage. You have to be courageous in life to accomplish everything you want to do. When you have courage, you can get there.
That's Yewe Narcisse, the lead singer of Zieti. We reached him on the line in Abidjan. More from him in a moment. Right now, let's turn to the American part of the band. Guitarist Michael Sharakis and drummer Alex Orr were living in Ivory Coast back in the late 1990s, before the violence began. And that's where they met their future bandmates, living in a shanty town.
It's a little quartier, a little neighborhood, which is just corrugated cardboard, you know, random wood, tin, you know, your typical developing world shanty.
The shanty, actually, it's right between the railroad track and the beach. It's like, you know, there's land that just wouldn't be used otherwise, so it gets used. That's Africa for you.
Tell me about your Ivorian bandmates.
Narcisse has been in Abidjan. He lives in a shanty near the airport. Meanwhile, Laurent's story is more dense. It's he comes from a family that was pretty well-to-do in the western part of the country. His father was an important man out there. And so Laurent's coming to the city to live in a shanty and play music. It was frowned upon by his family, very much so. Alex and I would get in his car and drive out to their shanty and pick them up and grab some instruments, battery-powered amps, and go out and find a little camping site, Le Camping. and we would set that stuff up with Alex's drum kit, and then we'd just start playing out there out by the beach.
Was there a particular song that you started to perform with these guys or write with them that made you think that this is the real deal, this was coming together?
The obvious choice is Ziondo. We went out to the western part of the country where they're from and played a show in Giglo, and they loved that song. Everyone danced, like old 90-year-old men and little kids, and they got in a big circle and were dancing around. And when we finished the song, they forced us to play it again a second time.
Forced us to play it again. And then the skies opened up.
And then
it poured.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For those of us who do not speak Yeré, can you tell us what the song is about?
It's basically a musician's creed. You know, our faith in music, and that faith lights the way to God and the eternal.
Yeah, it's acknowledgement that, you know, it's as he says, creativity, spirituality, knowledge, inspiration, all those are divine. And it's through our faith in music that our path is shined towards the divine.
So you decide, let's cut a record together with these guys. How did you do it?
Oh, it was easy.
No, well, there were many steps here.
Yeah, many steps.
We did a lot of demo recording with an 8-track cassette recorder that my brother brought me. And then right before we left in 1999, we recorded 10 songs in a studio in Abidjan, and that recording was lost. It was not backed up and destroyed.
So you two begin this process in 97. Both of you left Ivory Coast in 1999, but those recordings were lost.
Yes.
Right. Within months. Now, what happened to them?
Well, Studio Soft was not apparently as solid secure, as we thought.
Right.
It was
yes.
Truly soft. After we left the country, I met somebody here in the D.C. area who was building a studio back in Abidjan, an Ivorian man. And we became friends, and I helped him out a little bit. And so then they recorded some tracks in his studio and sent them to me, and we started building them back up here in my studio. So that's been the process. It's been this back and forth across the ocean.
This long transatlantic collaboration came close to never happening. A few years after Michael and Alex returned to the U.S., Ivory Coast's civil war broke out. Narcisse and Laurent went missing. Michael and Alex couldn't reach them. They had no idea if their bandmates were alive or dead. Eventually, they were able to locate Narcisse, and he picks up the story from here.
The two armies were approaching on either side of where I was staying. When they got there, they battled for 3 days. Where I took refuge, there was even more trouble. I was lucky just to get out of there. My friend Laurent, where he was trying to get by, everything was burned down. He had to escape to a village, not even a village, into the bush. He couldn't stay where he had been living.
Again, drummer Alex Orr.
We were worried we would speak with Narcisse in Abidjan, you know, say, well, you know, Laurent, il est là, but he didn't really have any news from him either. So we were hoping for the best, fearing the worst, and luckily it worked out, and we actually just spoke with him today on the phone, so it was great to, you know, to tell him that we were coming in and talking about the work that he did years ago.
We hadn't spoken to him for 5 years until today. We called him, we finally
Laurent,
got a phone number.
Wow.
For Laurent today, and 5 years later, we get to hear his voice. He's on his way to Abidjan to rejoin Narcisse.
Was there a point where you almost gave up on the idea of this band, of this record?
The thing is, just always remembering those, the way they sounded when we were playing, you know, acoustic guitars and literally coconut husks. That sounds corny, it sounds Gilligan's Island, but that's what we started off playing with, acoustic guitars and hitting on the back of coconuts and singing, and it was so beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what has kept this momentum going the whole time, is just remembering that and trying to recapture it in some measure.
Plans to bring Laurent and Narcisse to the United States and maybe tour with them?
Absolutely.
Love to. I think that road begins with us going back there to do another recording. We're taking one step at a time at this point, got this album out finally, and then we'll certainly be looking towards how we can get them over here. We'd love to.
I think setting them up over there is a great step towards bringing them over here. And so that's part of the plan, is making sure they have a stable situation that they can support themselves through music over there, and so it's not just an adventure for them to come here, it's something solid and working towards a future.
And as for Narcisse in Ivory Coast, he's been separated from his American bandmates for 13 years, so the release of this record almost seems unreal.
I had confidence in my brothers on the other side, Mike and Alex, but I also had lost a little bit of hope, frankly, because of everything that had happened in my country. I couldn't imagine a day when I would see my music played throughout the world. I thought I had lost something real. And with the courage of my brothers on the other side, God is in control. I'm very, 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 very happy.
Yewe Narcisse, Michael Sherakis, and Alex Orr are three members of the band Zieti. The fourth member is Tiende Laurent. Zieti's debut album is called Zemelowa. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. for the week ending March 11th, 2012. That's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our program was directed by Kenya Young and edited by Mathoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Petra Mayer, Brent Bachman, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Megan Kane, and Connor Donovan. Lauren Beneshu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. Thanks for tuning in.
Yeah, you.